Hey, it's Connor Hall, senior producer for Wrongful Conviction, back with another case update and more behind-the-scenes insights. And this story started just a few months after I was born in 1979. It's the murder of a prominent rabbi in the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn. And it finally came to some sort of closure this spring, 2026, with the exoneration of Carl Miller. And this story probably begins before 1979, and I suppose it'll never really end. And not just because justice is not going to be served to the victim or their family. Well, let me explain. Even saying the phrase, the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, it makes me hear a news broadcaster voice in my head. Not only because of the, you know, if it bleeds, it leads style of American media that colored my childhood, along with the peak of our city's murder rate during that time, but also there was a race riot there in the summer of 1991 between the black and Hasidic populations that lived there. And I remember hearing about it on the news nightly. And once you hear this story, you know, it kind of becomes hard to ignore that this tension that was released through this riot must have been boiling under the surface of this neighborhood before even this murder in 1979. Now, if you've been paying attention to recent manufactured outrage over this immigrant enclave map of New York City, it was at one time strictly self-segregated by ethnicity. Now it's just economics, but my people are at least ethnically Irish. When I was, you know, a teenager, I dated an Italian girl, a difference that now seems silly to even mention. But at the time, there were older folks in both of our families that like definitely looked at it as some sort of interracial arrangement. So you can imagine that the religious and actual skin tone differences between the black folks and the Hasidim in Crown Heights, that was probably even more difficult to overcome, even though both populations had something very deep in common as refugees of European-style discrimination. The Jews escaping systematic annihilation in Nazi Germany and the Soviet bloc, and then black folks escaping the Jim Crow South, only to come to places like New York where even the Irish and Italians still hated each other, and many of whom climbed out of economic dire straits by joining the police forces that systematically tortured and wrongfully incarcerated people like Carl Miller, who became some sort of sacrificial lamb to kind of diffuse the tension that came from the murder of a prominent rabbi in 1979, a tension that only would explode in 1991, while he had already been in prison for 11 years. Carl was later paroled after over 30 years in prison, just 3 years shy of the establishment of Brooklyn's Conviction Review Unit in 2013 under Ken Thompson, which I believe may have started in earnest to correct some of the terrifying history of police violence and misconduct, but it appears to have morphed into some kind of scene-washing apparatus that helps maintain the veneer of infallibility of our criminal legal system, which is operated by flawed human beings just like everything else is, despite the appearance of some higher calling in a commitment to public safety that is bastardized in stories like this one. And maybe you'll agree with my take when you hear Carl's story. The Brooklyn CRU accepted his case, turned over old investigative files, conducted an investigation, including interviews with witnesses that the jury never heard from, as well as those who testified. And after you hear this story, you're going to wonder why the hell they were ever believed. And all of it appears to support Carl's unwavering claim of innocence. But before actually doing what the CRU was established to do, the Brooklyn DA's office chose instead to meet Carl's team in court, proceeding to burn through over a decade of tax dollars in Carl's remaining years, fighting his innocence claims until April 1st, 2026, when a judge finally agreed with Carl, overturning his conviction on the grounds of actual innocence. Meanwhile, when asked for comment, the Brooklyn DA's office said they're still reviewing the decision. Like they plan to appeal or some shit. So let's, you know, just keep that in mind when you're listening to Carl's story and ask why this alleged progressive city agency spends tax dollars on fighting to maintain convictions like these. Do they kind of look insane for doing it? I mean, who benefits from that? Rabbi Okanoff? The Hasidic community? The rest of us here in New York? Anybody? Anybody? And while we ponder that, for the first time in 47 years, Carl Miller's name is finally free from the stain foisted upon him by police misconduct and violence. And maybe that sounds too harsh to call it violence, but what else is it when you kidnap someone for 31 years, steal their youth, steal a father from his children, and then enslave him? And if that sounds like hyperbole, I mean, would we think differently when it happens to us? Well, Carl and our other guests don't have to wonder.
On October 25th, 1979, Rabbi David Okanoff was walking with his prayer case in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, when an assailant approached, described as a young black man, about 5'9", 150 pounds. He shot the prominent rabbi, stole the prayer case, and ran into an apartment building. Eventually, NYPD found a young man named Darryl Brown who gave several accounts alleging that a local amateur boxer named Carl Miller had made some incriminating statements. Carl had an open warrant for assault, was brought in for a lineup, but the eyewitnesses didn't identify him. After he was processed for the previous assault charge and released, Carl approached Darryl Brown in the street. But Brown was not deterred. At trial, Brown testified that he had seen the whole thing from start to finish. So the prosecutor no longer needed the other eyewitnesses who did not identify Carl in the lineup. But this is wrongful conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction, where we have a story born out of racial and religious tension in New York City that existed certainly before the crime came in the late 70s, but also through the 90s and even today in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, between the black and Hasidic communities that live there. But before we get into how that relates to this story and the man who lived it, Carl Miller, I'd like to welcome back one of his attorneys, James Henning, to our show.
Pleasure to be back, Jason.
And this time you brought along another attorney who played a major role in this case, Carissa Calkin. Welcome.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce the man himself, Carl Miller. And as we record this right now, October 25th, 2023, it's not only his birthday, but also the 44th anniversary of the crime at the center of his wrongful conviction. So, Carl, I'm sure that colors how you see this day, but we hope that this one is a happy birthday, and thank you for choosing to spend some of it here with us.
And you're welcome.
Now, Carl, can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
I grew up in Crown Heights with my family. I went to public school 221. From there, went to James D. Lawrence, which is a 600 school. My mother and my father moved out, and I just hung around with some of the guys that I was associated with.
Carl did not have his parents around. For a while, he was expected to go out and handle his own business.
And you were married and you were a young father at the time, right?
I wasn't married at the time, but I was a young father.
I understand you were an amateur boxer.
Yeah, I did box for Izzy's Erling Youth and Recreation Center in Crown Heights. And I had a little reputation in the neighborhood as somebody that you didn't want to mess with.
And I think that unfortunately worked against him when he was wrongfully accused.
In the months leading up to the murder in question, Carl had been in a fight in which he was stabbed with a screwdriver and hospitalized with a collapsed lung, resulting in an open arrest warrant for assault, which seems wrong for someone defending themselves against deadly force, but that kind of unfair application of the law was nothing new to Carl.
I did have a confrontation with the 71st Precinct because they used to come around and get guys to go in for lineups, and I started telling them, don't do that. Because you're getting paid $5 for a lineup, but they're not giving you back the picture. So this is my way of like trying to keep them out of the police way.
Which is solid advice. We've seen misidentification start just that way in so many wrongful conviction cases. So as a young man, Carl had already witnessed injustices to give him that perspective. While in contrast, there appeared to be preferential treatment for the Hasidic community in Crown Heights.
It's a strong voting block. It's like you're not going to get elected mayor if you don't have the Hasidic community, because they will vote in droves for the candidate that their rabbi tells them to vote for.
The Hasidic community before and after World War II settled in Crown Heights, which had been anointed by the leaders of what is known as the Chabad or Chabad Lubavitch movement, many of whom had escaped persecution either at the hands of the Germans or those in the Soviet bloc before and after World War II. Curiously, the city allowed one of its most powerful voting blocs to operate their own police force, the Jewish Defense League, or JDL.
The hard charge behind that JDL philosophy was never again get yourself a gun. Don't rely on the cops. People lived in an era where the cops were herding you onto the trains to Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and Treblinka and whatnot. It's that Mir Khan slogan, never again. We're not going to be vulnerable. Imagine any other group in New York City having their own police force. There are two very distinct worlds there in the Crown Heights area. One that is set up with their own ambulance and emergency systems, and they've had a number of issues going up until recent days with those two communities bordering on each other.
The one that really stands out is the Crown Heights riot. But as I will say to people, prior to Crown Heights riots, you had like Victor Rowe. He was a guy that was accosted by the JDL. And
of course, you're talking about the awful incident on June 16, 1978, when approximately 20 Hasidic men beat a 16-year-old kid named Victor Rhodes into a coma that lasted for 2 months. And so obviously the tension was high in the area.
So it was always tension, but it wasn't the kind of tension that the Crown Heights riot had brought.
The Crown Heights riot took place in August 1991 when a young Hasidic man drove through a red light, veered off the road to avoid now oncoming traffic, and pinned 2 7-year-old black children under his car, one of whom, Gavin Cato, was killed, igniting a race riot.
The story at the scene was the Chabad ambulance showed up and went straight for the Hasidim while kids underneath the car and they're trying to lift it up.
The tension that was building for decades exploded. Jewish people and their businesses were attacked, and the violence played heavily into the 1993 mayoral election of Rudy Giuliani, who unseated New York City's first African-American mayor, David Dinkins. The unrest in Crown Heights was palpable in 1993 and was certainly present when Victor Rhodes was attacked in June of 78, as well as when Rabbi David Akhanov was murdered in October 79.
Rabbi David Akhanov, the victim in this case, was in his late 60s. He had been born in Ukraine in 1911, studied the Torah under communist rule there. Actually, after his bar mitzvah, he wanted to continue studying, but his parents wouldn't let him. So he went on a hunger strike until they gave up and let him. He ended up emigrating to the U.S. after learning that the KGB was looking into him. And he made efforts in the Crown Heights community to help other Jews who were living under oppression in Russia. So Rabbi Akhanov was, by all accounts, a very pious and charitable man. He was not somebody who seemed to deal with a lot of trappings, but he did have a regular prayer case that he would bring with him to pray. And it contained, and I'm going to butcher this terminology, his talis and his tefillin, which are religious implements used by Lubavitch Hasidim. So just before 7 a.m. on October 25th, 1979, he's on his way to yeshiva when he's shot.
This was a very high-profile case. We've got a very prominent rabbi in the community who was shot with a .32 caliber, point blank in the face. There were 2 eyewitnesses to this shooting.
Both of the eyewitnesses, Louis Fazio, who was not a member of the Hasidic community, and 16-year-old Shinania Sperlin, who was, it's pretty evident that they saw the same person running from the scene with Rabbi Akhanov's prayer case.
Now, the descriptions were actually remarkably similar from the 2 witnesses. A man who was black, 21 years old-ish, right? About 5'9", 150 pounds, medium build, medium hair, possibly wearing a hat and a dark jacket. Carl, does that description match you, or did it match you at that time?
At that time, I was probably about 180 pounds. Wear a little afro and wear too many hats. Very athletic, not slim, as they had described this person as being a slender person. That's not me.
They're talking about a guy who's 5'9", 150. You're about 6 feet tall, right?
Yeah.
There's a significant difference. You were a boxer, right? So what class of boxing?
I was in a light heavy.
Light heavyweight.
Middleweight, light heavyweight.
So the descriptions didn't match. What about alibis and things like that.
I was in Queens, New York, celebrating my birthday with my daughter's mother at the time. And I left her house, came back to Brooklyn, and that's when I learned about the rabbi being murdered.
Carl had spent the night in Queens, and even after lies and coercion, his daughter's mother, Joanne Davis, maintained that he was there that morning and not in Crown Heights at 7 a.m., murdering Rabbi Achanoff and running off with his prayer case into the apartment building at 565 Crown Street.
And that is where they end up finding a suitcase that belonged to an individual named Daryl Brown.
Rabbi Achanoff's prayer case is never found, and in an abandoned apartment, they find this suitcase belonging to Daryl Brown with his property in there. And 2 days later, he shows up at the precinct because he heard that they were looking for them.
Daryl Brown essentially ends up being the only person to ever implicate Carl Beller in this crime.
Right. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out the sort of misdirection play there, right?
You've also got the fact that Daryl Brown is repeatedly lying to them. His statements evolve. His initial statement indicates that he didn't see anything.
And then they received a second statement from Daryl Brown on November 8, 1979, while he was being treated at Kings County Hospital for a gunshot wound to the hand. Now, they never investigated the cause of the wound.
When they come back to him, presumably with the ability to turn the screws a little bit when he's in the hospital with the gunshot wound, he now says that he and two other friends had seen a Jewish man with some money in a pizza or falafel store, and Carl supposedly said, oh, you should have ripped him off, and that he had heard the shot and saw Carl near the scene.
Carl has always maintained that he was not present either for the murder or that day in the store. We only find out who that actually was much later.
Then Daryl Brown, in his third documented statement and his first sworn statement the next day on November 9th, he says that he had seen Carl near the scene and he tried to get into 565 Crown where I was staying. I've seen him with a 32 and I spoke to him the day before the crime about a Jew with money in a blue bag. And that's a quote, which is important because it departs from his testimony at trial.
On the strength of Daryl Brown's ever-shifting word, Carl was eventually charged with the murder. However, with his open arrest warrant for assault, his reputation as a neighborhood tough guy, and previous interactions with the 71st Precinct, they came looking for him way before Brown had ever made any statements, just a few days after the rabbi's murder in late October.
My sister told me that the police was looking for me to talk to me, and I called them, said, what are you looking me for? Oh, we want to talk to you about the homicide. Come to the precinct. I'm like, nah, we can talk. Nah, come to the precinct. Nah, I didn't go because I knew they was going to arrest me. So I had an open case. I had a warrant.
Which is completely within his rights.
And I think it was November 14th. They picked me up at my house, took me to the 69th precinct, questioned me about the homicide, but they arrested me for my warrant.
When Carl does get brought to the precinct, he offers to take a polygraph and provide his fingerprints. And police don't take his prints, but they do take a polygraph, which they claim Carl failed. He then stands in two lineups without counsel and is viewed by Shanina Sperlin and Louis Fazio, the two undisputed eyewitnesses, neither of whom identify him.
I was held on the warrant. They took me to Rockers Island, came back out, and I'm walking around the street. And people was telling me that this guy, Brown, was talking about me with the police. And I had a confrontation with him when I was asking him, why are you talking to the police about me about this case? Oh, they want me to say. And I'm not going to say nothing. I was just telling him, leave my name out of it because I had nothing to do with that at all. And this was around probably right after Thanksgiving.
Daryl Brown on November 29th is given a polygraph, quote, to test out his earlier statement, end quote, to the prosecutor. And according to the police, Brown's polygraph shows that he was telling the truth about everything, but there was some question about his withholding evidence from the police. Now think about that statement, because we know, number one, polygraphs aren't this nuanced now. They weren't this nuanced then. This was a tool for coercion.
It usually is. Polygraphs aren't even admissible in court. And I need our audience to remember that police are allowed to lie to you about evidence. And they routinely lie about polygraph results in order to coerce confessions.
When they arrested me on the 14th and I volunteered for the lineup, the guy had said that, oh, you was picked out in the lineup, which we come to learn that was not true, that I was never identified in no lineup. And then after I take the polygraph test, they said, oh, you failed. So I'm like, okay. I mean, I watched Perry Mason when I was a kid. So if I failed a lie to take the test and I was picked out in the lineup, what more evidence do you need to arrest me? But I wasn't arrested. I was arrested November 30th for this case.
After Darryl Brown gives that polygraph statement where, according to the police, he was truthful about everything, on the 30th, they put Darryl Brown in lineups. But what are you putting somebody in lineups for if they've told the truth about everything implicating another individual?
That's a good question. If I'm following this correctly, then they must have suspected that he might have been the guy, right?
It doesn't make sense to conclude otherwise. Either he's telling the truth about everything when he implicates Carl and, okay, authorize the arrest. Certainly, there's no basis the next day to put Darryl Brown in lineups unless you're saying maybe he's still not telling the truth about everything. And instead, what they do is revert to tunnel vision and authorize an arrest for Carl based entirely, this is undisputed, entirely on the accusation of Darryl Brown, his second differing sworn statement, his fourth or fifth differing documented statement since the murder. It's just a travesty.
When you coming off the street, you know, you got to fight within Rikers Island because that's how it was. So it can be really hard on the person that if you're not really up to it. And I was the type of person that I could defend myself. So I had no problem like that. You're just waiting to go to trial and prove my innocence.
So 9 months later, September 8th, 1980, you go to trial. And I'm assuming you were represented by a public defender?
Yes, I was represented by Howard Wisweiser. Guy come in and tell me, oh, I never lost a murder case. I didn't know you didn't have one until you had mine.
There were some very serious discovery issues here. Whether you want to blame it on trial counsel or whether you want to blame it on the prosecution, but two things that we now know happened just prior to trial, there's no indication that Carl knew at the time of trial. It's that Shanina Sperlin shows up at the Brooklyn DA's office and tells ADA Barbara Newman, the trial prosecutor, that he recognized a possible perpetrator in one of the lineups he viewed, but it's not the Carl Miller lineup. It's the Darryl Brown lineup. The other thing that is potentially, but we're not certain, disclosed on August 28th, 1980, about a week or so before Carl's trial starts, is that ADA Newman discloses that an individual named Barry Lee Jackson had been identified from photographs on or before October 27th, 1979, which is just 2 days after the murder. And in writing, whether this was received by Mr. Weisswasser or not, or whether it was taken as legitimate or not, she tells him that if he lacked any further discovery, he should tell her so she could provide it. Now, that's kind of a catch-22, and it's not how discovery works. He can't tell her if he's lacking something that he doesn't know about, and you're now on the eve of trial.
There were several other important Brady violations, including more alternate suspects, like a man named Derek Peterson, as well as a guy named Willie Easterling, who had been seen trying to sell religious artifacts in the area. Police reports did not demonstrate any follow-up and were not shared with the defense either. And this conduct was only compounded by presenting the ever-changing testimony of Darryl Brown. This time at trial, he said that he followed Carl that morning, saw him grab Akhenoff, who screamed before he was shot, then saw him run off to 565 Crown Street with the prayer case. And Carl's attorney did lean heavily on the inconsistencies between Brown's version of events and undisputed facts of the crime, as well as how Brown's testimony may have resulted from pressure from investigators.
Detective Sorrentino, who's the assigned detective here, testifies that he never told Darryl Brown he was a suspect, which, as we noted earlier, if after the fact of him giving you a completely truthful statement, you're placing him in lineups, there's only one reason to place somebody in a lineup: as the subject. Second, the court prohibited Carl's counsel from questioning Detective Sorrentino about whether he had ever put psychological pressure on a suspect. And there's one more thing. Darryl Brown's account of Rabbi Akhenoff's suitcase is not accurate. His prayer bag was a distinctive dark blue color. And in the early unrecorded police statement that Darryl Brown gives describing this bag, it is a dark blue bag. But by the time he gets to trial, it's a clear bag that he can see into and actually tell the type of felt material inside. And more concerning, it indicates to me one of two possible conclusions. One, Darryl Brown saw inside that bag or touched it. Two, Darryl Brown was told how that bag looked after he gave independent statements. Neither of them tend to support the reliability of the verdict in this case.
Darryl Brown also testified that Rabbi Achanoff made no attempt to block the bullet with his hand, which was contradicted by the state's forensic pathologist, citing the black powder stain and stippling on the back of the rabbi's hand. So while the defense seeded doubt about the state's witness, the state attacked Carl's alibi witness, his daughter's mother, Joanne Davis.
From everything in the transcript, everything on the record, all the materials we have, the only indication we can really come to is that Carl's alibi witness was really just spoken to in order to try and get impeachment material for her. And, you know, something else that we see as well, too, is that false statements are attributed to Carl's alibi witness, which is something that we very frequently see in these cases as well. You have unendorsed statements, you have unsigned statements. Then at trial, it's the detective's word against the witness's word.
In this case, the lead detective, Sorrentino, testified that Ms. Davis said that she saw Carl with the .32 caliber pistol, the kind of gun used to kill Achanoff, even though Ms. Davis denied ever saying that, but rather that she'd only seen him with a toy gun. In addition, Sorrentino testified that Ms. Davis's mother had said that Carl was not at her home the morning of the murder.
To the credit of Joanne Davis, she's actually asked under oath if her mother is stupid. She's told that Carl supposedly failed a polygraph. She's told that he may never come home, and she doesn't change her account.
The state referred to Ms. Davis's story as concocted, and they told the jury to, quote, wonder about the sense of someone who gave birth at 17. Woof.
Her credibility was unwarrantedly being attacked by the police and prosecutors.
The state made note that the main issue of the case was whether Darryl Brown had seen the shooting, calling the actual eyewitnesses nothing more than, quote, distractions, unquote. And that eyewitness, Louis Fazio, quote, didn't add anything to the case, unquote. They had to take this tact, after all, because Fazio was no help to them.
Fazio was initially subpoenaed by the people, right? So he gets into the courtroom and he tells his wife that Carl is too broad to have been the man that he saw.
As a result, Adia Newman doesn't call him, but the defense does.
He reiterated that he made this remark that Carl was too broad to have been the person that he saw. And he also basically said that he was not able to identify the person who he saw in the courtroom. So meaning, right, it's not Carl.
But the fact that ADA Newman had subpoenaed him makes two things ridiculous. She asks him, Mr. Fazio, were you wearing your glasses? As if this is supposed to impugn his account, even though she was going to call him as her witness previously, when she thought maybe it wouldn't denigrate her case. But second of all, how you could get up in summation and say he couldn't add anything to the case when you were calling him in a case that did not have a ton of witnesses testifying. He's one of two people that indisputably saw the perp running from this crime scene.
So Fazio was positive for the defense while Joanne Davis was brutally attacked. But then Carl's lawyer does something absolutely insane at the end of the trial.
It's absurd. It's in his own summation where the verdict is going to come down to a credibility contest between his civilian alibi witness and the sole witness for the prosecution. And first, the judge says on the record, well, it's probably improper for me to express an opinion, but I'm going to say it. I think the alibi has been pretty well discredited. And instead of Mr. Weisswasser standing up and advocating for his client, he says, quote, I wish I never heard the word alibi. And in his own summation, he points out supposed holes in Ms. Davis's testimony, denigrates her as a witness while calling Detective Sorrentino an excellent officer. It's a complete abdication of his duty to his client.
He didn't really do anything in defense of me. He really didn't. And a jury of 11 whites and one black. It was over 200 Hasidics inside and outside the court. The deck was stacked against me.
Predictably, the jury went out and they came back with guilty on all the counts, right? Felony murder, robbery in the first degree, and criminal possession of a weapon in the second degree.
When I was found guilty, it was like, wow, are you serious? Are you going to believe this guy that I killed this man? A lot of things was running through my head. I'm not going to be able to raise my son. I'm not going to be able to raise my daughter, you know, my sisters, my family. So it's a whole lot going through, a whole lot. I'm put on that bus to go up to Elmira. It's like, you know, the reality starts sitting in. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Get caught up in a lot of negative stuff that goes on in prison, or are you going to get yourself up out of there? For time being, you get caught up in a little bit of the negativity, stuff to stimulate yourself from the reality of being in prison. That's something that I did. To a couple of old timers pulled me to the side and said, hey, look, we read about your case. It don't seem right. You need to get your butt in the law library while your indictment ink is still fresh. I had an appeal attorney. He put together some type of brief that was straight up BS. And I wound up doing time, just trying to seek help from different people. Just keep pushing. Went to school, got a GED, legal research certificate, still trying to prove my innocence. Nobody would listen. The appeals was denied. Time come for your first parole board. I go in there, continue to maintain my innocence. That was in 2004. Go back in 2006, come back in 2008, same thing. Go back in 2010. And what was presented to the senior parole officer at the time is that Shanina Sperling and Louis Fazio did not identify me. The senior parole officer, he said, yo, you know, they always send up transcripts of the sentencing, but they never send up stuff like this. And he said, wow, I never knew this. So he said, well, the next parole hearing come up, I think you got a good shot with this commissioner. So I'm going to sit your paperwork in front of you. Just continue saying what you're saying, maintaining your innocence. Don't change. And I didn't. And lo and behold, I was paroled.
So you kind of glossed over a little bit, over 30 years that you spent in prison, right? Was it that long?
31.
31 years, right. It's amazing that you survived and that you seem to really have survived with your spirit intact. And it's also incredible that you were able to go to the parole board and do exactly the opposite of what people are advised to do, right? They want to hear remorse. They want to hear that sort of narrative, right? So for them to be able to act the way that they did shows that they must have known what you had known all along and what everyone should have known all along, which is that you were actually innocent.
Being released after 31 years, it was surreal. It was, wow, I'm walking the street. Oh, man, what am I going to do? Okay. Got to go see parole. That's kind of frustrating because you're still under supervision. Came out, got married, reconnected. What did I miss? I missed my daughter's first time walking. I missed my daughter's first grade. I missed my son's first grade. I missed my son's first baseball game. I missed so many things that you cannot get back. So when you come out, where do you pick up from? My daughter, because she was only a couple of months before I left. My son was 2. So you look at the time, so you're saying 31 and 33. These are young adults that have lived a life. So how could you interject as a father because this was taken away from you? So you do the best that you can. And that's all I've been doing since I've been out, is reconnecting with them, reconnecting with other family members and things of that nature. And then I got back into proving my innocence. And that's when I continued doing what I was doing. And I wrote to different people after Ken Thompson had set up the wrongful conviction unit that he has in the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office. And I had contacted them. Then I contacted James, and this is where we at now.
So where we are right now is we had cooperated for a bit with the conviction review unit here in Brooklyn. We'd received some materials we intend to use in support of a motion at some point. Ultimately, after they interviewed Carl and some of the witnesses in the case declined to be interviewed or could not be located, they closed out the case. But then this month, they reached back out and said that there has been a recent and unexpected development in the investigation of Carl's case, and that they're going to reopen the investigation, which I don't believe I've heard of them doing in any other case.
After we wrapped our first interview, we got a call from James and Carissa asking us to hold on production until they could meet with the Brooklyn DA's office. It turns out that back in 1979, a guy named Robert Sims gave a statement to corroborate Brown about Carl's alleged statement at the falafel or pizza store. Now, in October 2023, some new evidence came to light about Robert Sims and his wife, Linda Sims.
The Brooklyn CRU, in the course of their reinvestigation, had visited her house looking to speak with her husband, Robert Sims, and left a card there. And what we've been told is that Linda Sims, the wife, in January of 2023, reached out to her sister and sent a picture of the assistant's business card that had been left at the door. And when her sister asked, well, what is this about? She responded, well, Google Rabbi Crown Heights 1979. And the sister, Teresa, found articles on Rabbi Akhenob's murder. And she asked her sister, Linda, well, what did you do? And Linda responded, that's what I did. And Teresa, caring about her sister, said, well, what you need to do is get yourself an attorney and turn yourself in. And Linda, for many months, did not heed that advice. So by September-ish, it seems to be, Teresa, this was weighing very heavily on her, contacted the Brooklyn DA's office, and that's what spurred on the reopening of the investigation.
The confession from Linda to her sister Teresa continued, implicating Robert Sims.
Linda said, I did that. And then we, meaning her and Robert, brought it up to our father. He was very pissed off and sent me down south. Now, there's a fair inference that she was saying the both of us did this. And we now have additional evidence that Linda Sims' father, who was murdered in December 1980, shortly after Carl's trial, that at various points throughout 1979 and 1980, both Linda and Robert Sims had possession of his handgun. And additional information that has come out about Robert has certainly changed our assessment of him. Specifically, when he was interviewed by the CRU in relation to Carl's case, they did not know that in the early 2000s, he was carrying on this relationship outside of his marriage with Linda. She was a 20-something beautician. They had a child together, and she was found disposed of in a very rough fashion in an abandoned building. And Robert was brought to trial in Brooklyn for the murder and somehow acquitted. Obviously, the file is sealed following the acquittal, but it sounds like the only reason for the acquittal was that Robert pointed the finger to friends who had helped him dispose of the body and claimed that one of them was the actual murderer.
So what was the guy's name who took the fall?
Meltrius Walker.
Is he still serving time?
He's out now. He essentially says he came over to the house. The woman had been shot 4 times. And Robert said, I need you to help me take care of this. Now, what's even more interesting here is before the Brooklyn DA's office, the CRU had learned through Teresa, Linda's sister, about Robert's prior charge that he was acquitted of. They interviewed him. And he said he did not want to talk about his prior case, which he referred to as sort of a little incident, I believe, but he didn't want to get into the details. He said that he and Darryl Brown, the sole witness against Carl Miller, had been best friends for years up until that point, at which time they had a falling out because he asked Darryl Brown for some help with something. And Darryl Brown's response was, who the F do you think you are, John Gotti or something? And they haven't really spoken since. It sounds like Darryl was asked to do some dirty work for Robert.
Now, it's certainly plausible that Darryl Brown may have been responding to a request from Robert Sims for yet another big favor.
Going back to the original investigation, the statement attributed to Robert by police was that Robert and Darryl Brown, a day or a few days before Rabbi Akhenob's murder, had been in a pizza shop on Kingston Avenue and seen a Jewish man with a prayer bag full of money. And according to the police report, Robert and Darryl were thinking of robbing this man, but didn't. And when they later saw Carl Miller, they said, here's what we saw. And according to the police report, Carl said, oh, you should have ripped him off. Now, Carl has always denied making that statement. We have nothing from Darryl Brown on that statement at trial. We have him in a police report giving a different version of that. What Robert Sims did admit to us and to the CRU was that he was looking to get one of those bags. He was interested in robbing somebody. He denies that they had any conversation where Carl Miller said, yeah, you should have taken this guy off. And as Carl has said repeatedly, his response to that would have been, are you crazy? You're right across the street from the JDL and you're going to rob a guy like this? That's ridiculous.
So where does the case stand now with the CRU?
They have turned things over to us. We're gathering information and evidence to put a motion into court. We've had several people talk to us and give us additional evidence. We're feeling good that we can get ourselves a hearing where we can subpoena some of these people and get them in to give sworn testimony so we can weed out the truth here.
Absolutely. And now when we're working with the CIU, clearly there are ways and avenues for us to pursue. We just need people to speak up about it.
Carl deserves it. Rabbi Akhenov deserves to have the right person convicted of this crime. This is a case that is based on one person, Darryl Brown, his word. We're not here to judge you. Somebody was already judged in this case, and we submit that it was wrongful. Reach out to us. We'll talk to you. This isn't a witch hunt or something. We just want the truth. We're at 86 Livingston Street in Brooklyn. We want to get to the bottom of this.
So we'll definitely have your contact info linked in the episode description. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments, where first of all, I just want to thank you for joining us. And now I'm going to shut my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my headphones on, and just listen to anything else that you feel is left to be said. So let's start with James. Go to Carissa, and then finish it off with you, Carl.
One thing that I think we didn't get into, something that we only learned after we started cooperating with the CRU in this case, is that one of the people that we've seen pop up in a lot of these cases is a gentleman that your viewers are certainly familiar with, Detective Louis Scarsella. And he, it just so happens, pops up in this case. For reasons that have not been revealed to us, 2 days after the murder, then anti-crime officer Louis Scarsella is interviewed by the assisting detective Viola. And we have no information about that, but we do have information that former Detective Scarsella has been monitoring the progress of this case and the media accounts of this case. So again, I'll say the same thing I said about Darryl Brown. Mr. Scarsella, my phone is on. Information is information. We don't know how you factored into this. Again, I'll say we're not going to stop. There will be a resolution here, whether it's through the CRU, whether it's filing something. When Carl came to me, I said, we're going to fight this case. When Carissa read this case, she said, we're going to fight this case together. That's what we do. And we're going to keep moving forward. Reach out.
I'm just really happy that we were able to touch on the fact that Carl was released on parole, notwithstanding him maintaining his innocence. I think that is huge. Anyone who's familiar with the criminal justice process knows that is huge. And I really think it's no surprise that Fazio played a role in that. So as we're saying, if anyone has any more information similar to Fazio, maybe they saw something, just come forward.
I would like to say thank you in the Wrongful Conviction podcast for giving us the opportunity to have this out there in the public so that people can see, not just me, but there are a whole bunch of wrongful convictions. And as James and Carissa has stated, it's people that know me. If you know something that needs to be spoken on, speak on it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early and ad-free by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Kleiber. The music in this production was supplied by three-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
We have worked hard to ensure that all facts reported in this show are accurate. The views and opinions expressed by the individuals featured in this show are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Lava for Good.